Today, we're going to talk about something rarely talked about in the United States, economic and social rights. We don't just have a right to be free from torture. We also have a right to make a decent living, to have good health care, good schools. Today, in particular, we're going to discuss the $16.2 billion bonus that the investment banking house of Goldman Sachs in New York City announced for its employees just before Christmas. And our own Michael Smith will talk to two people about this, Professor Rick Wolf, formerly the head of the economics department at the University of Massachusetts. He is currently the NASDAQ professor of economics at the New School, and Kathy Albisa. She's the head of an organization called NESRI, the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. She, in particular, is concerned by economic and social rights as a legal matter.
Kathy Albisa, Professor Richard Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The thing that so startled, I think, anybody that opened up the New York Times last week and then again the week after and then again just a couple of days ago was this continuing story on how the investment banking house of Goldman Sachs made so much money last year, their holiday bonus to their partners and employees was $16.2 billion. Not million, billion dollars. $1,000 million. $16.2 billion. Here on Law and Disorder, we wanted to explore not just moral underpinnings of that sort of inequality of wealth, but the legal ones as well. Kathy Albisa, what was your reaction when you saw those New York Times stories?
Well, it did, in fact, make me think that we're sort of regressing back to both an economic and legal historical moment in time, sort of pre the Great Depression in this country, where capital was completely unregulated, where you had extraordinary disparities once we hit the Depression, and where there was no basic protection for economic and social rights.
Well,
and
what does the United Nations have to say about economic and social rights?
Well, in fact, from that experience, with the U.S. taking a strong leadership role, along with the experiences in World War II, came a crucially important document, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which protects civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights as interdependent and fundamental. And those rights include the ones we know of as our own constitutional rights, like speech and freedom of religion, et cetera. But it also includes at least six primary economic and social rights, those being health, education, adequate food, decent work, housing, and health.
Rick Wolf, what was your reaction when you opened up the Times, saw that first article on the $16.2 billion bonus?
Basically, for me, it was the capstone, the finishing touch on a period of now 30 years in the United States in which, as Kathy correctly says, all of the New Deal attempts to bring some sort of reduced inequality was given up. And for the last 30 years, it's been plunder and grab and get at the highest levels of the American economy, almost as if they understood that this is a special period when the kind of grabbing of wealth you had 100 years ago, associated with names like Rockefeller and Carnegie and Mellon, you haven't been able to do that for 100 years. Here's another chance for the next century's old rich people of America to become that, people with the good luck to be in a certain position to be able to walk away with stupefying amounts of money when nobody was either looking or in a position politically to stop them.
Kathy, what would the equivalent be of $16.2 billion if it was to be used for housing or health or even just wages for people?
Well, there are a great many human rights crises, one could call them, in this country that could be resolved even or certainly improved with those kind of resources. And what's important to recognize about that sort of extreme concentration of wealth is that it's not just that. It has repercussions for ordinary people on the other end. Whenever you see that kind of extreme concentration of wealth, you also see all kinds of social instability and insecurity, as we are seeing in this country today, with increasing numbers of people without access to basic health care, with people in inadequate housing rising at extreme levels, and the indicators of child poverty not improving, etc., wages stagnant. I mean, the indicators are endless. And what's important to remember, those two things are tied. It's not just the inequality. It's that the inequality represents a failure to protect basic rights of the vast number of people.
Where does that kind of money come from? It doesn't grow on trees. I mean, my notion was, if somebody's got a lot of money, somebody else doesn't have much. I mean, it's like a zero-sum game, isn't it?
Well, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But every time workers push for higher wages, the corporate executives, whose job it is, explain to the public that the reason they don't give the workers the higher wages is because if they did that, then everybody who bought the products would have to pay more in prices to pay for the wages. And so much as they would like to help the workers, they really can't because of their concern not to damage the ultimate buyer of the commodities they produce. These same corporate presidents don't make that argument when it comes to their own salaries. But the argument applies equally. If you pay your managers, as Mr. Blankfein of the Goldman Sachs is now getting, a bonus of $50-odd million for the year.
$51.5 million, yeah.
Yes. Huge amount of money. That, too, will be paid for. You're going to have to recoup the companies that either Goldman itself and what it charges, or the companies that hire Goldman and who have to get more money for the products they make to pay Goldman to do what they want Goldman to do. But sooner or later, that money shows up in the higher prices people pay. So the illusion that is so carefully cultivated among the American working people, this is a huge sum of money paid to these managers for the good work they do and is nothing to do with you, is a mistake. You will pay more for your Rice Krispies and your Coke and your hamburger. All of those things are produced by companies that hire Goldman Sachs, and what they must pay to Goldman is higher because Goldman executives are walking away with $50 million. So your hot dog will cost you more, pull more money out of your pocket because these people are drawing this kind of a salary.
What about the just abysmal conditions, not just for people in the United States, but in countries where people are making a dollar or two a day? How would $16.2 billion going into the hands of a handful of Goldman Sachs people affect people, say, in Kenya or the Philippines? And what's life like for them there?
I'm like, you know, you don't even have to go that far. In Florida, in the last 10 years, there have been 6 federal prosecutions of slavery, freeing thousands of workers, farm workers. And that's in Florida. The reason that slavery is a problem in Florida is because farm workers' wages have been stagnant for over 25 years. Sometimes the only way they can turn a profit, the growers in Florida, is to enslave their workers. That, in part, has to do with the concentrated buying power of big purchasers like McDonald's, like Walmart, who've been pushing down wages for all these decades. The growers, who are no saints because they've participated in this process, are actually not the ones making the profits if you look at the numbers. It's the big purchasers. And here you have farm workers making $7,000, some as low as $2,500 a year. You have regular incidents and regular prosecutions of slavery. In fact, there's one that's ongoing now that's been recently reported. So you don't even have to go that far to see that kind of destitution. Just go to Immokalee, Florida. Just call the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida and ask them what they've been battling down there for the last 10 or 15 years.
And how does that impact internationally, Rick?
Let me give you, an example of the kind of calculation that you need to make. The numbers are actually much larger than the $16 billion, because that's just what one large company does. Merrill Lynch does the same thing. Lehman Brothers does the same thing. All of the large financial corporations, and indeed many of the non-financial, that is the companies that produce things. Perhaps later we can talk about another story in the New York Times you may have seen. in which the president, ex-president of the Pfizer drug company, one of the largest American corporations, a guy named Hugh McKinnell, was given a severance package at the end of this year, because this is the last year that he was the president of the company. His severance package was $200 million, four times what Mr. Blankfein got as his bonus. He got that, and now he has $200 million, which come from the Pfizer drug company, which will have to recoup that money by charging more for all the medicines that everybody uses. Indeed, it's all I can do not to make the obvious suggestive joke, since Pfizer is the producer of Viagra, and it would lend itself to all kinds of humor. In any case, let's go back to Goldman Sachs. They are an investment banker. That is, they arrange for mergers between companies. When a company wants to buy another company, they will hire Goldman Sachs and so on. Many companies active in the third world, in the less developed part of the world, in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, will turn from time to time, because they have to Goldman Sachs to arrange for advantageous mergers, say, for government enterprises that are producing resources and so on. In other words, all over the less developed part of the world, governments and enterprises hire Goldman Sachs all the time and pay these enormous fees.
And what's also worth looking at is not only how much they're paying in form of these bonuses, but also that other aspects of our legal and policy infrastructure emphasize and deepen these inequalities. When you look at where we've been moving with our tax policy for the last number of years, not only are people making much larger sums of money in a very narrow slice of society, they're actually paying less into society. So they're getting all this from society, because I think it was Roosevelt who said, none of us could survive a day without at least 1,000 others, right? We're an interconnected economic system. Somebody puts the food on your table, somebody makes your furniture. None of these guys could survive a day without at least 1,000 others, probably many thousands given how they live. But the point is that they're getting an enormous amount from society, and they're being asked less and less of each day. The difference in poverty, for example, between Europe and the United States is not so much the difference in wages. What's different, if you look at the numbers, is the way the benefits and tax structure works. In the European systems, and unfortunately the move there is now away from that, but in the European system there's actually a lot more government investment in social well-being. And what we've done is we have lessened and lessened our investment in our social well-being, demanded less of the people who are in fact receiving most from society, and put ourselves in this very raggedy place in terms of our social infrastructure and economy.
Unlike Europe, working people in the United States don't have their own political instrument. They've got the Democratic Party that tries to pose as a friend of theirs, but in fact isn't. You see nobody in the Democratic Party, for example, complaining about the Goldman Sachs bonuses, because Goldman Sachs is one of the big funders of the Democratic Party. It was his investment banking houses, after all, that were the main backbone of the Clinton years, and probably be coughing up the bread for Hillary if she runs next time. Rick Wolf and Kathy Albisa, who are our guests here on Law and Disorder, I wanted to ask you what the effect of this is internationally, because these investment banking houses like Goldman Sachs or Merrill are not just national entities. They really have tentacles that go around the globe.
Well, much of what they do as enterprises is organize, merge. In a sense, they are the top of the pyramid. Their job is the kind of global organization of this phase of capitalism as a system. I think we should see that the kinds of fees they draw and the bonuses they pay reflect that role that they have. It's a moment in world history when capitalism feels itself as a system to be triumphant, to be unchallenged in the way that it was thought they might have been by the Soviet Union and China before. And so this is the moment in which to grab it all, since no one knows how long this lucky phase, if I can put it that way, will last. And so everything is, in a sense, subordinated to this drive for as long as it lasts. And I think the implicit part of your comment is correct, that this will last as long as the mass of people permit it. Not longer, but that long. And until there is a reaction, you won't see this change. in the nature of capitalism to produce profits, to compete to make more and more profits, we have nothing to be surprised about. Capitalism as a system for the 300 years it's been around has done this repeatedly. It's produced these booms. It's produced these bubbles. It's produced these cycles. It's produced these moments of incredible profit and inequality, and then it has had a crisis thereafter. And in each case, it's a question of whether the mass of people, the ones who ultimately produce this wealth, will they bring this to an end? Will they demand that the government step in and make it less harsh, as in the New Deal with Roosevelt? Or will they perhaps one day go one step further and ask whether or not a system that keeps producing this problem every so many years isn't what itself ought to be challenged and questioned?
I just want to pull back that question a little bit to the legal framework through which these things happen. Amartya Sen, who, as you know, is a very well-known and prize-winning economist, he says that market forces can be seen as operating through a system of legal relations, right? So these things don't happen in a vacuum. They happen within a system of legal relations. And what you see on the global scale is, in a sense, two competing systems of legal relations. You have the one that is, one might say at this point in time, although in theory legally binding, you could still say it's aspirational, which is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the even the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights.
The last time we had an intense concentration of a wealth grab on the scale we have now was at the end of the 19th century. And in reaction, the mass of American people who were as grossed out then as I think Americans are becoming now, there was a reaction. And in 1910, for the first time in American history, an income tax, federal income tax law was passed. And if you go back and you read that law, you will discover that only the top 4% of Americans were to be paying any tax at all. It was a tax on the richest, those who had so much that the government coming to tax a small portion of it would not affect them, but would give the government resources it could use. Over the years, the rich went to work to shift the burden of the income tax from themselves to the mass of Americans. But even as late as the 1970s, the top bracket, that is the level of income tax, the rate paid by the people at the top, was 91%. That means Mr. Blankfein, had he earned this money 35 years ago, would have had to pay out of his $50 million, 45 of them, to the government for its social programs as his income tax. Kathy's quite right. In the last 30 years, along with everything else, those income tax rates have been dropped drastically by more than half, leaving Mr. Blankfein and all the others with these bonuses to walk away with enormous amounts of money that otherwise would have enabled the government to provide social programs. So it is indeed a political, legal question whether to permit and allow this kind of grotesquerie to go on. But if I could make another point, I think working people are going to have to face a difficult and painful fact. When you react, as we did in 1910 with the income tax, and as we did again later with a high rate of income tax to try to get the wealthy, they have the means, the organization, and the desire to escape the results of the upsurges by working people to get the law changed. Sooner or later, it's going to have to be necessary to raise the question, if all we do is react when capitalism spins out of control with some government laws and rules which they can then undo, then the only solution is to change their capacity to do that, to raise the question, how is a corporation, an enterprise, organized? Will it always be organized by a mass of people who produce a profit that a small number of people grab into their hands, or are we going to change the basic structure so we don't face this cycle of wealth accumulation, reaction of a law to try to stop it, the undoing of that law, and then the whole process over again? Over the last 10 years, as 20 million people have seen the real value of what they get go down because the minimum wage stays the same but prices go up, has been the year when the wealthy have become relatively more wealthy at a pace we have not seen for 100 years. That's a society that is willing to watch the decimation of the mass of people who have little or nothing, side by side with the explosion of the wealth of those who already have more than they can spend. And we watch it and we observe it. And the only reaction I see, especially at the upper level, is actually revealed in the New York Times of Wednesday, December 27th, in which a little story appears that on the last hour of the last business day before the Christmas vacation, that's last Friday, the Securities and Exchange Commission reversed a rule it first passed last July requiring corporations to publicly reveal what they're giving in all the compensation for their top executives. So they, too, understand they need to control the perception. So they got the Securities and Exchange Commission to relieve them from the obligation of making it public.
Kathy Albisa, tell our listening audience, because it's really terrific the kind of work you're doing. Give us in a nutshell, will you, what your organization is all about. You founded it because it addresses itself exactly to what Rick has just been describing.
Yeah. The National Economic and Social Rights Initiative was founded in 2004. We describe it as promoting a human rights vision in the United States. And what we mean by that is a rights vision that includes economic and social rights that not only ensures basic needs for everyone, but also allows every person to develop their full potential. Because economic and social rights really aren't just about not starving, right? They're about allowing people to develop themselves, to protect basic dignity, et cetera. And because we believe that the only way you can support real change is through movement building and from the ground up, what we do is we support community organizers who are working towards incorporating that human rights perspective into their social justice campaigns. And there's been increasing interest in human rights as a vision for social justice advocacy in the United States over the last few years.
If our listeners will get a pen or a pencil, can you give it to them, please?
Oh, sure. NESRI, NESRI.org. And let's educate ourselves as to why we got into this situation. There's no time to get into this now, but the unraveling of economic and social rights in America has a big piece of that history. It's just something to keep in mind. I would urge everyone to read Eyes Off the Prize by Carol Anderson, which explores how race and economic and social rights have this bad chemistry experiment together in the United States.
Kathy Albisa, Rick Wolf, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for the opportunity.